Today's morning show get together on WRCO focuses on some statewide issues and local issues as well. We are pleased to have in the studio with us today State Senator Sarah Kievsky of the 14th Senate District back to join us. I guess we didn't scare her away the first time she was on.
Well, it's a little nerve-wracking, I will be honest, but I actually really love to be here, so thank you.
Great. And you were recently in the area and did some tours of different facilities.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so last Thursday, I was in Richland Center for the entire day, which was lovely. We packed it full. So I met with a group from ADRC locally that are doing just some really important work, especially for seniors, with concerns about what might happen with their budget, right? So they talked about that, the things that they're doing. I met with your mayor, Todd Copperdahl, and that was really interesting hearing about the innovative ideas that they have to try to do smart growth in the area, and also some of the limitations because of the topography of your city and how it lands, and how some of the building that you might want to do to grow in the area, particularly of housing, is a bit of a challenge. But it sounds like there's going to be some apartments that are being built, an apartment being built, and then there's going to be a residential area that's also going to be built, and so some single family homes will be there. So that was really exciting to hear about. I met with the Richland Hospital, pardon me, and that was really interesting. I met with a lot of people that are on the executive board, that simply work there, talking about the important work they're doing to elevate the health in this area, providing some really important services from a small rural hospital, which is hard to do these days. As we know, it's difficult with challenges with Medicaid. Right now, we're not sure about what cuts might be happening. We also know that the reimbursement rates are relatively low. And so we have this real difficult dynamic there that particularly impacts rural hospitals. And so we talked about that. But again, really highlighted some of the beautiful things that they're doing, including their obstetrics that they're making available, which a lot of places are closing. You know, They're not willing to take on the quote-unquote burden, the challenges of having birthing centers, but they're doing that. They're also providing mental health care with psychiatry, which is particularly important to me, and they're doing a really unique model where they have the psychiatrist meet with, along with the doctors, with the clients or patients, so that the doctor that is in regular contact with that person is able to help learn about the best practices for medication for these clients with the psychiatrist there, and then can ultimately take on that care without feeling overwhelmed because that's not their specialty, but they have this nice dual relationship that's really great. Let's see. And then I did a listening session. Let's see. Did I do anything else? Yes, I did a tour of the courthouse with Stacy, which was really great. Really interesting to see that beautiful building, but it needs, you know, work. And that's hard to come by when, you know, our budgets are so limited and in our smaller municipalities. But they're, you know, doing their best. And then I did a listening session. That was the fourth listening session I've had. That was at the Phoenix. Well attended. I think maybe around 30 people came, asked some really great questions, but presented a lot of concerns, anxiety about what's happening at the national level, how is that impact going to impact us, and how, as a state legislator, am I going to maybe be able to help protect them from that? So great questions, a lot of distress presented, and trying to remain hopeful about you know, the awareness that we have as a party with the governor's help to try to do things thoughtfully now with the budget that might be able to fill some of those holes if we have to. Cross our fingers, we don't have to, but it looks like we might.
With your background and you know, mental health concerns and the anxiety that you talked about, what do you commonly tell people? Because people are worked up on both sides.
Oh, gosh. You know, that is one of my biggest concerns, really, is what we know is the human brain does not like uncertainty. It likes clarity. It likes structure. It likes certainty. And so when there is uncertainty, it creates anxiety. And right now, there's so much uncertainty in so many ways, right? So, I mean, we're talking at the national level, what's happening. We're talking about internationally what's happening. We're talking in our local economies, what's going to happen, or with referendums or that didn't pass or did, or, you know, choices that are being made. And so the uncertainty level of just the state of things is so high that the anxiety is increasing exponentially. And we had a mental health crisis previously. We knew that we had a greater need for mental health services and more people in distress. My concern is this is just growing. And we already are struggling to manage all of those people that need care, right? And so what I'm trying to do is sort of back off and go, I understand. I feel it too. I mean, I'm as human as the next person, right? I might be in politics, but that does not mean that I don't have as much as anxiety as anyone else. I have 6 children. I have my own, you know, savings account. I have my own bills to pay. I'm just as concerned about me and my small circle, right, of people and how it's affecting them, my mom, who's on Social Security, right? And I'm concerned about my constituents, needless to say. So I carry this heavy weight of concern also because I want to do everything I can to protect the people that now I'm responsible for. And it was 6 people of my children, and now it's 100 and about 57 people as my constituents, right? And so I have a great sense of responsibility and anxiety. What I'm trying to impress upon people is that there are 3 ways that we can activate, right? And that we can speak to those in higher positions of power, especially at the national level where all these decisions are being made. Those are the courts. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that are being done there, trying to, you know, the AG, our AG is suing with multiple other AGs from other states, saying, hey, you can't do this. You can't impact us in these negative ways. You can't just throw out people that are, you know, legally here, for example, and impact our working population, our immigrant population in these ways. You can't just do things with no regard for law. We have to have due process, right? So there's that happening. We have Congress that is trying, but unfortunately right now it's the Democrats trying to kind of put some blocks, not really Republicans. Although today it sounds like there's a few grumbling out there now going, hey, wait a minute, these tariffs that are coming are really going to impact all of us. It does not matter what party we're from, everyone's pocketbook, especially those of us that are of working class, our pocketbooks are all going to be affected by these tariffs. And there's some people that are now starting to speak out a little bit, and my hope is that grows, to recognize that this is going to be damaging to everyone, these really extreme measures. And then, and all the cuts that have been happening across the board, to everything from cancer research to, you know, potentially Meals on Wheels. So again, it's the courts, it's the Congress, and then it's constituents, it's people power. And right now, what I tell people is that is where your power is. You have a voice, you have a vote, you have a buying power, you have letter writing skills, you have calling opportunities, you have, you know, stand firm in what you believe in. You can post about it, you can talk with your neighbors about it, you can go to a protest about it. Share what you feel, share what you're concerned about, because this is only going to stop or be halted or better managed if we all come to the table and say, this is too much, too fast, too brash. Real people are being negatively impacted in such dire ways. I can't tell you the stories that I hear. I mean, yesterday, for example, I was at a home in Sauk City. I was working with Meals on Wheels. Just volunteering in the area.
Good for you.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going off on a tangent. Is that okay?
That's all right.
Okay. So I was working Meals on Wheels and doing delivery. I really wanted to see what the, you know, just what's this program about? I just love learning about all these things that are happening. They're kind of quietly happening in the background, right? Supporting people and all these people that are either doing the job or volunteering. And so I met with the people that are doing this in Sauk City, serving these elderly residents, and then got to pack the meals and got to go to the homes and meet individuals. And I met a gentleman named James, and he was historically a dairy farmer up in the Oshkosh area. And he lost his farm in the farm crisis in the 1980s and talked, you know, and we just got talking because I'm a farm kid, right? And so we just got talking about his history and stuff. And then he went to deliver things. He was a truck driver and now obviously retired and subsisting on pretty much Social Security, right? And then now Meals on Wheels is offering through ADRC, this Aging and Disability Resource Center, which is fundamental in many of our communities. And so he's subsisting on these services. You know, they're helping him, he and his wife. And so we're delivering a meal yesterday to them. And we got talking. And he's talking about, you know, gosh, I'm really worried that this isn't going to be around anymore. You know, I'm really concerned about what's going to happen because I'm hearing things about maybe cuts to Social Security, cuts to, you know, our Medicaid. And he goes, and you know, I paid in. I mean, I was a hardworking farmer and I paid in, and now they're, you know, they're going to maybe cut this or it's going to, you know, go away. I hear some, you know, he didn't call this guy a knucklehead, but I will, talking about it being a Ponzi scheme, Elon Musk. And so we talked about it and then I said, you know, I'm a state senator, that, you know, and they just started to talk more, right? You know, about please help us, please protect us, please let it be known that we're concerned and we're worried. And I can't tell you like how heavy hearted I was. This is two people that are going to be deeply affected by these kinds of changes if they happen. And so I left there saying, I promise to do my very best to fight for what I can. But again, I go back to those voices then come to me and I will continue with my voice, but I also need everybody else to continue with their voice. We, you know, one of the beliefs I have is action is the antidote to despair, right? We need to get active. We can't, when we get despairing, oftentimes we want to kind of huddle into a corner and maybe, you know, crawl in under our blankets and hide, right? Because it's so debilitating. We get so overwhelmed. We're already overwhelmed. We can't. We have to fight. And so that's what I tell people. Fight. Fight, 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 fight.
We were overwhelmed with all of the election ads, too. So I think a lot of people have less anxiety now that that has passed,
yes,
and things
indeed.
Like that. But let's look back on the election Tuesday and your thoughts.
Yeah, so I, too, was anxious. I saw two people running for the Supreme Court in Wisconsin, and I had my preference, but then I saw a billionaire come in, spend $25 million of his own money, and Brad Schimmel saying that he was going to be someone that is supporting Trump's moves in, you know, he's going to try to keep that agenda going. I mean, their ads had Trump on them. How can we say that they can be then fair-minded, you know, open-minded, if you're saying right on those ads that you're in alignment? I found that so troubling. And I thought it was offensive to have one fella come in here, right, and start giving away $1 million if you're willing to like support his candidate. I thought, quite frankly, if someone on the Democratic side had done that, I know they keep on talking about this Soros fellow that I don't really know much about. I've never met him. He's never paid me anything. But if that had been something that happened on our side. I hope I got, you know, I know I would be one of the people that said, that is disgusting. That is inappropriate. We can't be doing that. Money in politics with Citizens United has gone way too far. We need to back that off, not go in even further. It feels like they leaned in, right? And so I hope. And I think, right, because we saw the incredible outpouring of people voting and we won by a 10-point spread, I hope that was a message that says, no, we are not going to be bought like that. We are unwilling to be subjected to high elite megalomaniacs that are willing to say what we're going to have, what we should do in our state of Wisconsin. We have a say, and we said it firmly, and I'm so proud. And then we had private schools being protected. I was so glad that Jill Underly was elected again. She wants to protect our public schools. The other person is really in for public schools, voucher schools, and taking more of our taxpayer money to support private or voucher schools. That is siphoning away from our private schools, and that is just inappropriate. Again, that's just not where our public dollars should go for public schools. So I was very excited that she got reelected. As far as the constitutional amendment, you know, it was already and has been in place that we're supposed to have voter ID. And so it is redundant. We already had it. Should we have it? Yes. That's why we had it. And so putting it in a constitutional amendment, okay, I guess. But I'm not sure that we want to be monkeying with the Constitution. That can open a door that I'm not real comfortable opening long term in multiple ways. I think we need to be very, very thoughtful and securing our Constitution. And so that one, you know, that passed, and so be it.
Mm-hmm. Some bills that you were recently a part of, the Right to Repair Bill, which affects farmers. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So, Senator Brad Paff is a great advocate for our agricultural industry, and I have joined the Agricultural Committee proudly. And so one of the bills that we co-introduced is this Right to Repair Bill. The concept behind it is right now what happens is when a farmer buys this, you know, it's machinery these days is really expensive, and it's often computerized in an advanced way. And right now, what is required is that machinery to be fixed has to go to a dealership to be fixed by their mechanics. That's a monopoly practice, really. And so this is the Right to Repair is essentially saying to these manufacturers of these of this machinery, you need to, at a fair price, make available the tools, the documentation, the supplies needed to repair this equipment so that the farmer can do it or someone that they trust, an independent repair person in their community, could also have access to it. Again, at a fair price. We're not trying to take away their important intellectual property, but we're trying, so it's safe, but we're wanting to make sure that they have access to this, because when it helps their bottom line, right? If they're able to fix it or have somebody else locally fix it, there's not as much capacity of having sort of a monopoly on the prices, right? So it's going to help their bottom dollar. It's going to help maybe small repair shops be able to have a little bit more business. So it could help small businesses in the area. And what we know is when machinery is being used, it's when we're planting or when we're harvesting. And when other people are planting and harvesting, that's when it breaks down, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is imperative that we have the ability to do repairs expeditiously, right away, right? We can't be waiting, and that's part of the dilemma. If we have a very small, filtered number of people that can repair, we have to then be waiting. If they're already busy with somebody else's, that is fundamentally not healthy for our crops and our efficiency. And so this bill is to try to help those farmers.
Okay. And I know another one was hedge funds purchasing single family homes. That was a concern as well.
Yeah, so this one came about because, you know, I've been hearing so much about the crisis of affordability and accessibility of homes. And so we did some research, like, well, what's out there? What's available? What could we do about this? And one of the things that we learned about was how hedge funds, so these are investors that are able to pool their money and then make purchases. And basically with that kind of pooled money, they have almost unlimited buying ability. And what we've seen is these hedge funds are purchasing single family homes in urban districts. Right now, we've seen it particularly in Milwaukee in our state. And there were approximately three, and we have statistics are a little bit limited, but in around 2022, there were about three that had purchased at least 1,500 single family homes that they were then turning into rentals. And the dilemma with that, right, is that if they are able to purchase these homes, again, with their unlimited pocketbooks, they can drive up prices. And they do, right? Because they can just buy something sight unseen, you know, and when that happens, it takes off the marketplace properties that then these aspiring homeowners would have available to them. Then those people can't build their own wealth, right? The wealth goes into these hedge funds, because what they can do then is turn them into rental properties, heighten the rental prices because they start to monopolize that area, right? And really price out people from being able to afford these things, and creating, again, more higher prices in these rental areas, more disruption in even just the stability of those communities, because then we might have, you know, renters that are coming in and out, rather than, you know, home ownership that is a stabilizing force in these communities. So all the way around, it's a negative thing, ultimately for working class people. So we wrote a bill that was formulated with the initial idea from a Republican in Virginia. Now, theirs was really complicated, and that it didn't go real far because it got so into the weeds. We just made ours simple. We said no hedge funds can purchase single-family homes in the state of Wisconsin, and if they do, this doesn't go for anything in the past. If they do, going forward, it will be forfeited, and our attorney general will be initiating a removal of that property from them so that that cannot happen. It's a way to dissuade people from doing that. And my hope is that it passes. Cross my fingers that it gets bipartisan support, and really is, again, a recognition of our housing crisis. And it can't fix all things, but it can also be a piece of what we do to help working class families build their wealth and be able to manage the prices that are exponentially increasing with housing costs.
That's a real dilemma, not only the hedge fund problem, but a lot of houses are going for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 above the asking price right
exactly.
now in some of those communities.
Exactly. Well, the reality is we bought our house, my husband and I, in the Lodi area. We bought our house in 2017. Right now, if you look at, you know, like the Zillow or whatever, the price of it, we couldn't afford it.
Right.
We couldn't afford it. We are not wealthy people. We don't aspire to be highly wealthy people. We just want to live decently, right? And that's really the case for most people. They just want to be able to live decently. They want to be able to have a bit of accrual of monetary benefit to having property. But here's the thing. In my area, while it sounds great, oh my gosh, my house costs more, right? It's not that great, because if I sell it, I can't buy anything locally, because everything is cost more, right? So then I'm priced out of my own community. So this isn't that great. Even though it is prosperity in some ways for me with this house, it is also a dilemma, because it will then push out just working class people in these smaller communities, or in any community really. And that is then a detriment to building wealth for anybody that's just, again, working class.
Sarah Kiesky in the morning show today. State Senator Kiesky, we're glad to have her in here. And we'll have a little bit more on the conversation coming up when the morning show continues. Senator Sarah Kieski, our guest in the morning show today from WRCO Radio. Great to have you back in the studio. We kind of left talking about hedge funds and buying houses and things like that. So far, what's the support for that been like?
So that bill was presented, gosh, I'm thinking a week and a half ago now. And so what happens with these bills is they get presented to really all of the legislators and say, here's the idea, right? I asked a couple people to co-sign with me. And so, you know, I just presented it to them first. And I said, what do you think of this bill? So I had a senator, again, it was Brad Paff. He co-signed with me. Representative DeSanto and Representative Haywood also signed on with me. So I knew that there was some appreciation for it. Those were Democrats that I have relationships with. And then presented it to the whole, you know, all senators, all assembly members. Right now, we have 29 people signed on, which is actually really good. A lot of bills have maybe 5-ish, 6-ish, you know, that's just kind of how it goes. And so to have 29 is so exciting. I feel just so proud of that. Unfortunately, they are only all Democrats, which again, I mean, I just fundamentally can't understand. This should be bipartisan. There was a Republican in Virginia that presented this bill. So I thought, you know, hey, let's try to do something that even Republicans, I mean, I literally thought that would be kind of a selling point. And we put that in the literature about it, like FYI, right? There's no one there. Now, does that mean that they wouldn't vote for it? Not necessarily, but here's the dilemma. If they are not signed on to it, what I'm finding is that it probably will not come up for a hearing because it's not getting Republican support. Republicans are the head of each of the committees, right? And those committees then decide if a bill that is presented to their committee, I'm not sure what committee this will go to, that the head of that committee, which is a Republican, will decide, will I give this bill a hearing? Because then once it gets a hearing, then we either decide as a group on that committee to pass it into the bigger body, right, the whole Senate to vote on or not. If it doesn't even get a hearing, it dies. This potentially will die and not even get any notice, any conversation, right? I mean, if it's not good on its merits, then take it to the hearing and show me that. Show me that. And then okay. But don't just not even have it have a hearing, because if there's something wrong with it that we could fundamentally improve with like an amendment, let me do that. I want to help people. And the fact that it might not even get a hearing, and I'm hoping it does, and bring me back and I will let you know, right? I will be back. But if it doesn't get a hearing, this tells you, again, how broken the system is for somebody that is eager, hopeful, desiring of bipartisanship. This is telling you where the blockade is. And it's heartbreaking and it's infuriating.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the maddening thing about politics, because I truthfully can see good on both sides,
I do too.
And I think a lot of people can. Looking at a bill, you know, whether it's this or that, it seems like it's a no-brainer, but you don't want one side to look better than the other, make your side look good or bad. I mean,
yeah, but see,
that's maddening.
That's silly. What we should do is make our state look good.
Right.
What we should do is help our people prosper and feel good. Right. Like that should be our goal. It's not about what party looks good or bad. That's like so selfish, really. Mm-hmm. And so the dilemma is like if you look at what bills I've signed on to, they are blue and red. Right. Like I think even more red bills, probably because they're the ones that, you know, I've just thought some of those were good and maybe there's not as many bills, blue quote unquote bills that are come out. But nonetheless, I think of the ones that I've signed on to and said, yes, I will support this. I will co-sponsor this, right? There's at least, I would say, 2/3 that are Republican bills. Because you're right. I don't think we have, as Democrats, the monopoly on smart ideas. by any means. I think there's lots of smart ideas with Republicans. I think there's also, you know, not great ideas on both sides of the party. And so those I won't vote for. And that has happened. I have not voted with my party already a couple of times on the Senate floor.
Are you in trouble?
No, I'm not in trouble. They're willing to give us leeway to say, what do you believe? What do your constituents need? Where do you stand? And so, you know, they ask me, well, why? And I'll tell them, right? But they're willing to give me that freedom because they know I got elected by my constituents. And so I'm representing them. And so, you know, sometimes that means that something that works maybe in another community doesn't work for my community. And so far, you know, that's already been something that I've done. And I'll continue to do. And will that gain me favor with all people? No. Do I care? Not really. Because if I'm doing my job, that's where my integrity lies, right? It's not who I'm making best friends with or who's not upset with me. It's about who am I helping. And so, you know, as I've said, and this is, you know, maybe not really appropriate, but I'm not in this job to keep this job. I'm in this job to spend my political capital to do this job. And what happens after 4 years is going to be up to the people.
Mm-hmm. Good attitude to have, I think. And locally, anything come up as far as the local campus? I know that when you were doing the listening session, anybody come up with any questions about that? Or can you see anything moving forward?
Yeah. Well, that conversation actually has come up multiple times about the Richland campus. I've talked about it with multiple people, including I met with the UW chancellor. We did a day where we traveled around together, and that was really interesting. And I talked with her a bit about it and talked with the mayor about it. Unfortunately, it sounds like something that was sadly in the works for a long time to just underfund it. And then ultimately, you know, if you don't feed something, it eventually dies, right? I mean, you talk about a person, a plant, you know, right? And that's kind of what it sounds like happened here. And people are still, you know, impacted by those consequences. One of the things I talked with the mayor about was kind of what are some possibilities for these buildings? What are ideas? And so that's what they're looking at. You know, what are possible avenues to maybe use these properties well and to support the community? And again, I think it's a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. Last time you were here, you were talking about the postpartum care.
Yeah.
How's that one stand right
okay,
now?
Okay, so once again, so this is the postpartum bill. So it is asking that the Medicaid expands supporting mothers that are on Medicaid from 2 months to a year. Because what we know is these mothers, and by the way, this was something that was brought up in the conversation I had with Richland Hospital, because this is huge for them, that we help those mothers with their postnatal care because there are issues post-birth, right, post-delivery, that are significant. It can be related to things with breastfeeding. It can be related to pelvic floor issues. It can be related to mental health issues. And those issues are not just within the first 60 days. There are 49 states now that have expanded this from the 60 days to a year. There used to be two states that didn't. Wisconsin was one. Arkansas was one. Arkansas has now passed it. As I understand, we are now the only one. That is egregious. I mean, because we're talking about all states recognize this important bill being the expansion. Right now, there are approximately 90 legislators that are signed on to expand Medicaid expansion, including multiple Republicans. Because again, this is a real bipartisan issue. When you see that it's being passed in Arkansas and California, right? Like, you know, like this is something that can serve everybody, red or blue. And so, But unfortunately, so of those 90 that are signed on to this, again, that's not saying all the people that will actually also vote, 90, both Republicans and Democrats, there are 132 legislators, 33 that come from the Senate, 99 that come from the Assembly. So 90 of those have signed on. There's one person, Representative Voss, that is the majority, so Republican, leader of the Assembly. He has said that a vote on this is, quote unquote, unlikely. He is then putting the brakes, potentially, on something that we fundamentally need, that would be helpful for mothers, that would be helpful for their babies, their other children, their our economies, because then they can work better if they're taken care of, if they're returning to the workforce. This helps in so many ways and is, again, every other state. And we have one man that is right now saying it's unlikely, because you know who gets to decide? Him, if it comes up for a vote on his floor. That is, I don't even know the word, right? Like malicious, inhumane, egregious. I mean, awful. It's awful.
You'll have a listening session today in our area, correct?
I do. Yes. So I'm going to be in the area doing a tour today and over in Plain, I should say. And then I have the listening session in Plain at 2:00 today.
Okay.
2 to, I think, 3:30. And Sarah Godlewski, our Secretary of State, is going to be there with me. And Representative Karen DeSanto is also going to join me. So the three of us will be at the listening session.
Great opportunity for people in the area. I hope they'll show up.
Yes, I hope everybody shows up. Ask me your questions, right? Give me your concerns. I'm representing everybody, and I need to hear from everybody. And I do take questions from everybody.
And you have a meeting coming up here. We got to let you go a little early this morning. You're going to be busy here at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, so I am on the Ag Committee, and we are going to be hearing some bills. There's going to be some hearings today on, I think, 4 different bills. So I need to be there listening, and then hopefully, again, once we have the hearing on these things, we will then have a vote on it and see. And many of them, I think all 4 of them, I'm in support of. I'm trying to remember one of them is about giving incentives for grazing. So some farmers can have more grazing land and have some financial support with that, incentives. There's others. But it's some exciting stuff, some good stuff. And I'm eager to listen in, and most likely will be voting for them unless I hear otherwise.
Okay. And we'll be maybe asking you about that the next time you come back to the studios.
Yeah, please do. I will be back.
All right. I appreciate that. State Senator Sarah Kievsky joining us, representing the 14th Senate District on this portion of the morning show.